KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Woodrow Wilson has a compelling history. He was 10 years old by the time he learned to read, and yet he ultimately became a scholar and the president of Princeton University, and later the United States. He led the country through its First World War and established the League of Nations. A serious stroke left his entire left side paralyzed, and his disability became the argument for the 25th Amendment. A. Scott Berg has a new biography of Wilson, and he spoke about it at Town Hall on September 18th, 2013. The talk was moderated by KUOW's Steve Scher.
Hello, folks. This is almost like being on the radio, seeing people again. It's been a while. Thanks for coming out. We're going to talk for a little bit. You're going to have some questions. Mr. Berg is going to sign some books. You're going to buy some books. Do all sorts of stuff. New York Times today, this was the headline. Considering the U.S. response to the Syrian war, the U.S. has a long history of isolationism. The Times, in listing it, they started with Lindbergh, that's where they started, but they could have gone all the way back to Wilson, right?
They could have, in terms of isolation. I mean, we were an isolationist country, really, until 1917, quite specifically until April 2nd, 1917, when Woodrow Wilson gave a speech, and there's a single line in that speech that changed everything, and to this day, our foreign policy goes back to that one sentence, which is, the world must be made safe for democracy. And as recently as last week, President Obama was out there talking about Syria and raising a lot of questions. He was asking, should the United States be the policeman of the world? When you see a madman gassing 1,000 of his own people and killing them, killing children, can the United States just sit there and do nothing? Do we have a moral obligation? And these were the very questions embedded in Wilson's statement. He was saying, we have reached a position of a certain amount of greatness. Even though this country has not been attacked, is there not reason, should there not be a moral component to American foreign policy that says we have to look out for something bigger? We have to be interested in human rights, was a phrase he used.
Now, Wilson ran on a slogan in 1916, he kept us out of war. Was the Wilson who gave that speech in 1917 a substantially different thinker than the Wilson who ran in 1912?
He was substantially different from the candidate who ran in 1912, no question about that. By 1914, he was inaugurated in 13. By 1914, the world went to war. He did everything he could to keep us out of the war for several years, but German militarism, German navalism, German torpedoing of ships, such as the Lusitania in 1915, on which 100 American souls had been and went down, over the next several years, the German belligerence just got greater and greater. And Wilson, I think, saw the inevitability of America getting into the war. But he resisted as much as he could. He hesitated as much as he could. Again, there's a kind of Obama reference here, I think. You know, when the Syria thing broke out, a lot of people were blaming Obama for hesitating too much, for not rushing in, not doing something more aggressive. And I thought, no, this is very Wilsonian, what Obama is doing. Whether you like that or not, or agree with that or not, it was Wilson-like in nature, because Wilson always believed maybe some solution will happen. Maybe some people will come to their senses. Maybe people will stop rattling their sabers. But what happened in 1917 finally was, after Wilson did run on the slogan, "He kept us out of war," the Germans made it very clear that, well, they actually changed their policy. They said they were now going to go after neutral ships. That meant even American ships in their waters, they were going to torpedo. And that was it. And I think it also reached a point, and this is something foreign leaders have had to deal with ever since and up to this day. At what point is national security being threatened by appearing to be too weak? And Wilson was certainly not into posturing. He was quite the opposite of that. He was a modest man, and he believed there should be a certain amount of modesty to the United States. But also, at a certain point, there is a breaking point. Maybe some people call it a red line.
So did Wilson. Where could you find in Wilson's earlier writings, when he was still president at Princeton, the moral philosophy that gave us League of Nations, the idea of going to war, human rights?
You won't find it in his writings so much, which are strangely not that spiritual or that much about religion or morality. But you find it in everything else in Woodrow Wilson's life. This was a man who was the son of a Presbyterian minister, the grandson of a Presbyterian minister, and you could go back 12 generations and find Woodrows and Wilsons who were Presbyterian ministers. There was a deep sense of religion, spirituality, morality, and also being a good Scots Presbyterian, there's a really good streak also of politics running through that. He was very proud of being a descendant of the Covenanters in Scotland, those who fought the British crown. And part of being Presbyterian in Wilson's mind was this great combination of education, religion, and politics. So you see that infusing everything Wilson ever thought and said. So you can see that kind of growing. Such that by the time we get to 1917, it's subtle. It's all in nuance. And it really didn't come together until that moment that he made this great statement.
You know, there's on the cover of this book is, and I know you all can't really see it, but on the cover of this book is a bit of a sort of our expectation of a presidential look and this president, how we've seen him. There's a few pictures that you have in this book, and one, I wish we could blow it up, but he's got a handlebar mustache that would do the handlebar mustache grower quite proud. He's a much younger man. It's a big, bushy handlebar mustache. Who was that guy?
Well,
How did that guy come there?
Well, that guy, I mean, it's almost Rhett Butler-like or Gaylord Ravenel from Showboat or something. Yeah, I mean, he was sort of the quintessential Southern guy. And that's an often forgotten aspect of Woodrow Wilson, which is he was a Southern guy. This is a man who was born in 1856 in Virginia and was raised in four states of the Confederacy. And Wilson, after he went to Princeton, he then went to University of Virginia Law School. He moved to Atlanta, where he practiced law for a while. He fell in love with a Presbyterian minister's daughter in Georgia. And then he began a life in academia. And so all those early years, really up until he was about age 30, he did adopt the handlebar thing, but he was the Southern gentleman, actually, who lost a lot of his Southerness when he went north to college in New Jersey, in Princeton.
You know, you quote Wilson, he's younger, this is after his first year of college, and he's come back, and he says he's going to dedicate his 17 years. He has spent, he says, he writes, I think, spent 17 years serving the devil, and now he was going to dedicate his life to serving the other side. That's looking at his life. Serving the devil seemed pretty strong words.
Those were pretty strong words, and those, I think, were the words of a 17-year-old. I think he was being pretty dramatic, and he was still very much in the sway of his very compelling minister father. The Reverend Wilson was this rather forbidding figure, and young Woodrow, or actually young Tommy, as he was known, his real name was Thomas Woodrow Wilson, and he was known as Tommy really until he went to law school. And that fellow, I think, was still very much concerned about the devil and paid very close attention to it. And then, interesting enough, you know, when Wilson became president of Princeton, which he did in 1902, he began to say the purpose of a college education is to teach young men to think as differently from their fathers as possible. And I think Wilson wasn't at that point yet at 17 when he's talking about the devil. He was still thinking very much like his father. And I think gradually he got away from that. He never lost his truly spiritual nature. I believe Woodrow Wilson is the most religious president we've ever had.
Really?
I believe so. Although somebody told me John Tyler was deeply religious as well. I haven't checked that out. But this much I can say about Wilson. He got on his knees and prayed twice a day. He said grace before every meal. He read the Bible every night of his life. So that's somebody with religion running through his veins.
Didn't you quote one of his friends as saying, the trouble with Wilson was he was a confounded, Bellamy. Called him a confounded Calvinist.
He was all those things. Now the friend that was still Tommy Wilson he was talking about. That was still a teenaged Wilson, but it does show you how dyed in the wool Wilson. Well, I was going to say actually he's from the South. How dyed in the cotton Wilson was. I mean that was part of his DNA, and he never lost that. Although he did clothe it, he masked a lot of it over the years. Because I was writing his book, I am not religious, and I was very mindful of that. I was sort of looking for it all the time. And I thought, for somebody this spiritual, he really never offended me with his religiosity, either as president or in his speeches before that.
All right. How did you decide that Woodrow Wilson was going to be the subject of this biography written about Hollywood people, Katharine Hepburn, Lindbergh? How did Wilson come onto your scene?
Those are sort of two questions. Wilson came onto my scene when I was 15 years old and growing up in Pacific Palisades, California. And it actually began, and this is a wonderful lesson for mothers, fathers, grandparents, anyone who knows a younger person. But when I was 15, my mother pressed a book into my hands, which was a book about Woodrow Wilson. And it just hit me at the right moment or something, because I read this book and became obsessed with Woodrow Wilson. And I'm certain I was the only kid on my block with a poster of Woodrow Wilson on his wall. And I tell you quite honestly that since that time, when I then went off to college, went on into life, wherever I've lived, several houses over the years, I have never been more than a few feet from a picture of some sort of Woodrow Wilson.
Well, what was it?
Well, it was, I think when I was 15, it was Wilson's Tragic Idealism. Because I was deeply into tragic idealism at 15. And in fact, on my wall, I don't want you to think I was a strange kid with just Woodrow Wilson's picture on my wall. I also had F. Scott Fitzgerald, Adlai Stevenson, and Don Quixote. Now, do you see a through line?
Yeah.
Now, and then there was another through line, which is three out of the four went to Princeton. Quixote did not go there. he didn't get in, and so but the other three all did, and so that's where I thought about, really the only serious place I thought about going to college. Now, to answer the real part of your question, when I was writing my first book, which was a biography of Max Perkins, the great book editor who discovered Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Thomas Wolfe, and 25 other important American writers, I was about a year or two into that book, and you have to remember, I had never written anything longer than a postcard in my life. But as I was doing that, I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful not just to write a biography, but to write a shelf full of biographies of 20th century American cultural figures. I've always been intrigued by Americana, and I thought I would love to write a half dozen books, and each book will be a different wedge of the apple pie. So Max Perkins was the story of a ninth generation white Anglo-Saxon Protestant who went to Harvard and lived on the East Coast and went into book publishing. My next book was the story of a semi-literate teenage runaway Jewish Pole named Shmuel Gelbfish, who changed his name to Samuel Goldwyn and invented Hollywood, lived on the West Coast. Then I turned to Charles Lindbergh, a great Midwesterner who really embodied aviation and modern celebrity in this country. Parenthetically, I did a book on my friend Katharine Hepburn, with whom I had a 20-year friendship. But then I began to think, okay, I haven't written about a Southern figure. And as I've already made clear, he was very much a Southern figure. I hadn't written about somebody in politics or government. And also higher education, and this is another aspect of Wilson's life that most people don't know about, that Wilson, probably more than any other person in this country, reformed higher education. And if you went to a college or university in which you majored in something, in which there was a sequence of courses within your major, and then you took some electives and maybe had two lectures a week and a class, maybe an honor code in there, all that is Woodrow Wilson. He combined all those things into what we think of as college education.
What preceded? What was it like before?
Before that, basically, there were two or three required sequences that you would follow in college. Education was a process of recitation and regurgitation. A professor would stand in front of 15 or how many ever were in his class, and he would recite to you, and then the next day you would be called on to recite back what he had said. And professors, even at the finest schools, would then call on somebody and say, okay, now you stand up and tell me about Horace's odes or something like that, and then do it in Latin. And so it was just a regurgitation process. And Wilson, his greatest contribution, and he started this at Princeton, and it really spread everywhere, but he started something called the preceptorial method, in which, as president of the school, overnight he imported 50 young scholars, young professors, whose job was, fine, have the older guys do their lectures, but once a week, a small class, not even a class, five or six students will sit with a preceptor and discuss what they had read. They wouldn't spit back what they had heard from the professor. They would actually have a conversation amongst themselves with the preceptor guiding the conversation. And this was a very new concept. It was, you know, part of it was taken from the Oxford Don system, but he really turned it into something else. And that really is very much with us today. Again, Wilson believed young men, and I think he would say women now, should be trained to think as differently from their fathers as possible.
A. Scott Berg, the author of Wilson, a biography of Woodrow Wilson. He spoke at Town Hall on September 18th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from A. Scott Berg in a moment. 926-949-KUOW. Over the last year, the number of women incarcerated in Washington state prisons has increased 7%. This spring, the State Department of Corrections started a new program for female prisoners that involves a number of significant changes, including treatment and therapy programs. The goal is to reduce recidivism rates. Jane Parnell is superintendent of the Washington Corrections Center for Women in Gig Harbor. We'll talk with her tomorrow during the noon hour. Forecast for tonight, lows near 40, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers this evening, chance of rain after midnight. Friday highs mid to upper 40s, breezy, rain at times. Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting writer and humorist John Hodgman, appearing live at the Neptune on Friday, November 22nd. Known for his appearances on The Daily Show and This American Life. Tickets for this all-ages show available now at stgpresents.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. It's been a century since Woodrow Wilson's inauguration. What kind of legacy has he left behind? A. Scott Berg's new biography of Wilson came out earlier this fall. Berg spoke on September 18th at Town Hall. The talk was moderated by KUOW's Steve Scher.
You write that Wilson went to college and he created his own bibliography.
He
wanted to read the things that he wanted to read.
He did. And I think a lot of that was behind his reforms of a college education. He realized that the greatest work he did as a student, and he was a prodigious student. He wasn't a brilliant student, but he worked harder than anybody else. But I think he realized he got the most out of the work he did on his own. Camping out in the library, creating, as you suggest, his own bibliography, following his own strengths, his own pursuits. Really, that is what he thought every student should have, that luxury, and that chance to focus on that which interests you most.
I'm gonna land here. I'm going to go to the past, then I'm going to go up in his life.
Okay.
A little bit. But what was, you write about this a lot, just explain why it was important to focus on this controversy that Wilson faced as president in terms of donors and donors' demands with the money that they would give to Princeton.
Ah, yes. Wilson, who had done so much reforming at Princeton, and he really, obviously, he gutted the whole undergraduate curriculum and redid all that. It was very important to him that Princeton, which in the late 19th, early 20th century, was really less of a college than what his predecessor called it, the finest country club in America. This was simply a place where sons of very rich men camped out for 4 years. And Wilson really wanted to turn this into a major academic institution. And in so doing, he thought it wasn't enough just to reform the education they provided, but the society there. And he thought the social life was somewhat corrupt, in fact. And he felt that students such as he had been, a minister's son who didn't really have money or power, he thought they were second-class citizens. And this becomes a theme in Wilson's life right up to and through his presidency, this aspect of leveling the playing field wherever he went. And so, to activate all these great reforms Wilson had, like bringing in 50 new faculty members overnight, that required a lot of money. So he had to go to a lot of these very rich people, raise a lot of money, and, you know, he was able to do it because there was a lot of goodwill banked, but it reached a point where they were saying, wait a minute, you mean you're going to sort of change the country club? We like the way it functions. And so they began to come down hard on him. It was extremely important to Wilson that there be a kind of wall, a firewall between the donors and their desires. His feeling was, if you're giving money to the institution, you are entrusting me and the trustees to determine how best to spend that money. And it is not up to you, just because you're rich, to determine what course this university should follow.
How'd that work out for him?
Well, it worked out great for a while, and then it worked out not so great, because he realized he was really up against them. And I think it had reached a point where after 7 or 8 years of just sweeping reforms, they had really just about had it. And there were one or two things he really fought over, and they were losing battles. And they were seemingly trivial. One of them was about where the graduate college was going to be located. And Wilson turned it into, because he knew this is what it was, more of a societal battle. He realized that the rich donors wanted to keep graduate education as a kind of private enclave for the very rich. And Wilson saw graduate education as a place where young men such as himself could really advance in society and could advance society. So that was extremely important to him, and he was on the verge of losing that battle when, well, I was going to say miraculously, but it was, he would say providentially, an offer was dropped on the table in front of him that had nothing to do with Princeton University,
yeah,
which was something that came from the bosses of the political democratic machine in the most corrupt state in the Union, New Jersey, who went looking for a puppet. And they thought, let's go after this guy Woodrow Wilson and make him ours.
All right, you talked about Wilson being a complex character.
Yeah.
So he's young, hypersensitive,
yeah,
dyslexic,
yeah,
couldn't read until he was 10, irritable digestion, plagued him all his life. His father taught him orally. His father would basically teach him, share stories with him, and then they would talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
His father, an inspiration, as you said, broke with the church that he was part of to support the Confederacy.
He did.
And the laws of the Confederacy. And slavery.
He did.
So now, the historian Wilson, that writes and thinks about this stuff much later, how did he perceive of the reasons for the Civil War?
Now wait, I'm sorry, how did he
think about, I'm taking it back to his father, how did he think about why the U.S. fought the Civil War, why the Civil War came to be, and what the Confederacy's reason for being was?
Yeah. Slavery is the immediate issue. That's certainly the issue on the surface. And that was certainly an important part of things. And Wilson's father was giving sermons talking about how the Bible supports slavery. So Wilson grew up with that tradition. But as Wilson grew older and became an historian himself and wrote about all the causes of this, slavery really was just the tip of the iceberg. Beneath that, you know, the Civil War wasn't really fought over whether we can have slaves or not. Beneath that was a whole economic structure. I mean, the entire South functioned on the fact that there was this free labor source, basically. So that was important. Now, with this huge, successful economy also comes a whole society. And with that was a system that had worked very well in the Confederacy, unless, of course, you were an African-American. And then it was pretty terrible. But, you know, this is the way for centuries these people had perceived things, the South, the Southerners, the slave owners. And so it was something that really came to trouble Wilson a lot, because he himself was no supporter of slavery. But he fought with racial issues in his mind all his life. And as president, it's really one of the great black marks against him, I think, as president, which is the fact that he did introduce Jim Crow. That is, he segregated the federal offices while he was president of the United States, which in turn sanctioned segregation anywhere in the country where any state wanted to do it.
Did he condemn slavery ever?
He did condemn slavery. He did. Yes, he was never pro-slavery. Strangely enough, if you can imagine, and this is, you know, it's difficult to talk about race in 2013 without setting the table completely, because people don't understand just how terribly racist this country was. I still think it's way too racist in a lot of ways, and you have only to go online and read some comments about a president we have today who is half white. But some of the commentary is breathtaking how racist it is.
Well, he's ensnared in that thinking.
Well, no question about it. No question about it. Wilson didn't have an antipathy toward black people. That was not an issue for him. When Wilson segregated Washington, D.C., it was not to subjugate blacks. I think he really believed in the law of the land then, which was the last court decision on that subject in 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson, which defined separate but equal. And I think Wilson believed at that time separate but equal was a good idea. He believed the country in 1913 when he became president was simply not ready for integration. He often talked about how it'll take at least a generation, probably two generations, before this country is ready. He often said that he was from the South. He understood that part of the country. He knew those people. He had seen incidents in which they tried to integrate, and it ended up in fights, in deaths. He didn't want that on his watch. And so he introduced this rather regressive system. As I said, I don't condone it in any way, and especially 100 years later. And sometimes I would read some of his sentiments. I have a couple of statements in there that I had never seen published, actually, which really showed deep down he did think there was a difference between black people and white people. So he wrestled with that. As president, he always kept the door open to African-American petitioners. He listened to them. Most of them left his office feeling charmed. And one of the great African-American activists of the day, James Weldon Johnson, also maybe one of the greatest writers, he had a meeting with Wilson, and he walked away, and he said, you know, I really have to get over my prejudice of Woodrow Wilson. But he still said, I don't trust him. So there was that, too. And he was right on both counts.
Well, Wilson was the leader. He came in and he changed the federal government with all these progressive strategies that we're still living with today. Did he believe those progressive ideals extended to African Americans?
I think he felt they would one day fully, but...
Education, too?
Oh, yes. He always believed in that, although when he was the president of Princeton, a black applicant applied to Princeton, and he did everything short of saying you can't come. He did everything to urge him to apply elsewhere. And his thinking, again, was Princeton was very largely Southern. It had a great Southern contingent, and he just knew the school would not stand it. It was as simple as that. Now, would another leader have stood up and said, guys, this is the new order, this is the new world, we admit human beings here, we don't judge people by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character? Would that have made sense? Would that have played? Maybe.
Why did he change his ideas about women and suffrage?
Wilson, he grew on the question of women's suffrage. Now, he was never against woman suffrage. And this is a bit of a cop-out, what I'm about to say. He did believe it should be done state by state and that there shouldn't be a federal amendment to the Constitution. But gradually, he changed. And by 1916, 1917, as we were now, 1917, getting into the war, he began to see two things. First of all, we were fighting this great war overseas in the name of liberty and democracy and all that, and how is it that he, as the leader of America, was leaving out half the population? So that deeply concerned him and troubled him. Second, he saw the great role women were playing on the home front during the war in every sort of way. And he said, this is just undeniable. How can we ask these people to work as hard as they are, women, and not give them a say in the government? And so almost overnight, he turned on a dime and became the leading advocate in this country for woman suffrage. And indeed, within a year, it was passed, and all women really applauded him then. Even the Alice Pauls, if you know Alice Paul, was the great liberal faction of the women's suffrage movement. So Wilson became a great champion of women's rights. He also had three daughters, and I think that made a difference. And it's interesting to me, as I was writing a lot about, and I have a great deal on women getting the vote in this book, but while all that was going on, there was a lot of gay rights talk going on in America here, and there are great parallels between those two sexual movements, if you will. What I basically felt was each of them was really more about generations than about gender. It was interesting. Woodrow Wilson's wife was against women having the vote. Theodore Roosevelt's wife was against women having the vote. But all their daughters were very much for having the vote. So, you know, and almost everybody over 50 didn't want to change things. Everybody under 50 did. It was just a movement whose time had come. And not to go back to race, but that's rather the way Wilson thought things would happen with race at a certain point.
A. Scott Berg, the author of Wilson, a biography of Woodrow Wilson. He spoke at Town Hall on September 18th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from A. Scott Berg in a moment, 944, 94.9 KUOW. A look at the weekend weather forecast with Nick Bond, the Washington State climatologist at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. That'll be during the noon hour tomorrow. Almost every world religion teaches some version of the Golden Rule. It's a founding moral principle that guides most societies. Philosopher and scientist Joshua Green studies the neuroscience behind morality. He wants to know when the community good trumps a biological drive towards self-preservation and why. We'll talk with him about his book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them, tomorrow afternoon at 1. Lows near 40 tonight, mostly cloudy. A chance of showers this evening, a chance of rain after midnight. Friday, highs mid to upper 40s, breezy, rain at times. Gloria Gaynor is Michael Feinstein's guest this week on Song Travels. She's best known for her 1978 hit I Will Survive, which is the winner of the only Grammy ever awarded for Best Disco Recording. Gloria Gaynor will perform My Funny Valentine, and she'll duet with Michael for The Very Thought of You on Song Travels, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from Eastside Prep, a co-ed independent school in Kirkland that inspires students to think, act, lead, and innovate, serving grades 5 through 12 with an average class size of 15. Next open house is on November 16th. Information online at eastsideprep.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. A. Scott Berg is a biographer whose books include Kate, Remembered, a biography of Katharine Hepburn, and Lindbergh, which won the Pulitzer Prize. His most recent book is about Woodrow Wilson. Berg spoke at Town Hall on September 18th. The talk was moderated by KUOW's Steve Scher.
What did you learn about Wilson, the effort to create the League of Nations, the effort to lead America into this new role? In doing research on this book, what new ideas or new tragedies emerged for you?
Well, I think the biggest tragedy that emerged for me is that I think Wilson really shot himself in the foot. And I think Wilson's tragedy was largely of his own making.
Really?
Yeah, I think in many ways Wilson stabbed himself in the heart. And I think Wilson's greatest strength was his stubbornness, his intractability, the fact that he wouldn't compromise, wouldn't budge. That was a real strength. It was also his fatal weakness. And when he made a few compromises in Paris so that he could get the League of Nations into the treaty. He brought that treaty home. He being a constitutional scholar, knowing, yes, he can draft the treaty, but it requires the Senate to ratify the treaty. And the now growingly Republican Senate was not going to ratify it. So Wilson took this cause to the people, embarked on a 29-city tour around the country to try to sell the country on the League of Nations, on his treaty, and halfway through collapsed and then suffered a stroke. Now, the treaty is still before the Congress, before the Senate, to be voted on. And they were offering some compromises. And up until the bitter end, there was even a compromise that was relatively minor. And Wilson, had he given an inch, really could have had his mile, and he wouldn't give it.
Was he mentally compromised? Is that why he didn't do it?
This is a question I certainly pose in the book, because he had suffered a stroke. And I should add that this stroke, it paralyzed his left side. He could still speak. He could still reason. He could remember. He didn't lose his mental faculties. But you asked the million-dollar question, especially now as we know more about the effects strokes have on our emotions. Yes, I have to think, to a large degree, this stroke did affect him. It made him sort of more of what he was. And I think this happens, you know, even when you have a cold, not a stroke, you get more impatient. You have to husband your time. You only have so much power in a given day. It's just okay. You get more irritable. I want to do this now. And if not that, fine. Then forget it. And that was very much Wilson's attitude with the League of Nations. And in the end, he yielded nothing. And in the end, he got nothing.
Did his wife run the government while he was incapacitated?
Well, yes. Now, it has been asserted that the second Mrs. Wilson, because his first wife died after they were in the White House for a year, which was tragic. He was madly in love with his first wife, wrote thousands of passionate love letters to this woman, many of which I have in the book, and many of which I found just sickening. It was enough already. But
And then he did it again with his second wife.
And they're even more passionate. Because now he's, you know...
He's that dude with the handlebar mustache.
Well, exactly. You know, it all comes out, you know? And, you know, he's now in his 50s. And this is sort of his last stab at love, I think he figured. And he really needed... He needed companionship. He loved women. He really did. And he rather worshipped them, too. And so this second wife, now, here's Woodrow Wilson in bed with a stroke. Now, Mrs. Wilson, and this is a wonderful and terrible story, I believe, because Mrs. Wilson believed in one big thing, and that was her husband's health. And the doctors said to her, you know, any agitation is really going to severely affect the president's health. I mean, it could be fatal. We really must keep all tension away from him. And her reaction was, well, that's what the president is. That's all he does all day is deal with tension. And then the doctor suggested to her, well, maybe you should just sort of run things. And indeed, as I suggest in the book, and here's the awful side of it, that Mrs. Woodrow Wilson and a handful of doctors and one or two people in the White House, I think, perpetrated the greatest conspiracy in the history of the White House, which is they kept a secret that the president had suffered a stroke. They kept this from the world basically for a year and a half. Virtually nobody saw the president of the United States. This is just shocking. I mean, it's just one of the most amazing stories in American history, I think.
He emerges towards the end of his second term.
Exactly.
He comes to some tables. He's always sitting. People don't see him walking.
Exactly right. And in fact, there was a moment after a couple of months, and he had, I mean, if you think tensions are bad today between Democrats and Republicans, and I'm not being glib, in Woodrow Wilson's day, it was as ferocious as it has ever been, I believe. And after a couple of months, the Republicans, who really have Wilson down now, you know, I mean, they think they've defeated his League of Nations and his treaty and all that, and now everyone knew he had a collapse. They thought it was just a breakdown of some sorts, a physical breakdown, but they didn't know he had a stroke. But now, after it's been a couple of months and they haven't seen the president, they start to say, well, we'd like to see him. We'd like to send a committee to the White House to see what's going on with the president of the United States. Now, Wilson, sly fox that he is, you see, and I told you he hasn't lost his brain power, he basically says, great, send him on over, bring him over, and he stages this whole little act while they come over. He has the bedroom perfectly lit. He's propped up with pillows in bed. He's buried his dead arm under the blankets. He's placed little props all around so he could be very busy moving things, looking very animated and this and that. And finally, one of his great rivals, Senator Fall, who's kind of a crook as well, had some deal going on in Mexico, he comes in for this meeting, and Wilson nods at him, and Senator Fall said, Mr. President, it's so good to see you. And Wilson just sort of nods, and that's kind of that. And he said, you know, Mr. President, we have all been praying for your health. And Wilson just said, which way, Senator? The meeting's over. I mean, clearly he had all his marbles. So that was sort of that. And then Wilson said, oh, and how's that deal in Mexico going? And well, Senator Fall couldn't get out of there fast enough. You know, and reporting, he said, you know, if we're all as unhealthy as Woodrow Wilson, you know. So.
Well, there's a lot of other stuff. He is, as you say, a complex, tragic figure. There's a lot of stuff. The last part of this book, Wilson's life after his tenure, it's great. It's really nice. You wrote that the U.S. had undergone more profound changes in the 2 years of the war than any time in history. Expand on that.
Whew. Well, okay. We were an isolationist, peacetime nation with an army the size of that of Portugal. in 1916. Over the next 2 years, as we went and won the war, we mobilized, that is, Wilson mobilized this country, sent 2 million Americans overseas. And by overseas, I don't mean a little army crossing the Hellespont. We crossed the Atlantic Ocean, which was quite something. This country completely altered its economy. We built up, I believe, the first military-industrial complex in the world. America became this giant superpower. Its entire economy changed. America became, because we were making the world safe for democracy, did we become the policeman of the world? To a large extent, we did. We did become, though, the first modern superpower in the 20th century. And that has not changed for a century. Now, trickle everything else down, and then you've got women getting the vote. You've got the rise of communism for the first time happening. You've got trusts being busted. You've got labor completely changing in this country. So just about every walk of American life underwent some profound change to such an extent that there is hardly an element of American life today that you cannot trace back directly to Woodrow Wilson's presidency. And as I suggest early in my book, FDR's New Deal, Harry Truman's Fair Deal, LBJ's Great Society, all those great progressive movements are really just further extensions of Woodrow Wilson's new freedom. So that's what I meant.
A. Scott Berg, the author of Wilson, A Biography of Woodrow Wilson. He spoke at Town Hall on September 18th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, offering complete holiday meals, natural meats, seasonal recipes, and more, with 9 neighborhood locations. More information at pccnaturalmarkets.com/holiday.
Join KUOW for Radiolab's new live show, Apocalyptical, in Seattle, November 21st at the Paramount Theater, featuring special guest Reggie Watts and music by On Fillmore and Noveller. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
9:58 and change, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. And I'm asking, where does our sense of right and wrong come from? That's what the folks at Radiolab ask themselves. We'll hear about it tomorrow night. We're going to look inside the brains of people contemplating moral dilemmas. We'll also watch chimps at a primate research center sharing berries with one another. We'll observe 3-year-olds fighting over toys. We'll take a tour of Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, considered to be the world's first true penitentiary, and a story of land-grabbing, indentured servitude, and slumlording in the fourth grade. Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7. Forecast says lows near 40 tonight, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers this evening, chance of rain after midnight. Breezy and rain at times on Friday.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.